Come on, gents. Welcome to the 7th episode of the First Ever Podcast. I'm your host, Paul Eastwood. With me is Michael Thornton.
Hey, friends. How's it going?
And Greg Noe.
Hey.
All right. Well, we've got a lot to talk about today, but first up, I think the two of you would like to talk about a game you've both been playing, Dragon Quest IX.
Yeah, and I was particularly interested in this one because I had played Dragon Quest VIII. That was actually my first entry into the series. And before all this retro revival fever with WiiWare and all that, I tried Dragon Quest VIII and had that nostalgia that I craved and really fell in love with it. So I was interested in picking up IX, read a ton of stuff on the internet since it came in Japan about 6 or 7 months beforehand. And I'm loving the game so far. They got rid of random encounters, which I think is wonderful. I can't stand random encounters in this day and age. I used to be able to handle it, but
now, Greg, I know that you you have somewhat of an antagonistic viewpoint toward Japanese RPGs. So, what's Dragon Quest IX doing for you?
I'm also really enjoying it. This is my first Dragon Quest game since playing the Dragon Warrior games on the NES.
Oh, wow, okay.
So, it's been a long time. I guess I was usually very... I always enjoyed playing Japanese RPGs growing up, but right. I was, you know, they were more like Final Fantasy, they were more lighthearted affairs, and Dragon Quest always seemed like, one of the more hardcore titles that have been coming out over the last couple decades. But I'm enjoying it. I definitely like the lack of random battles.
Okay.
They still happen when you're out on sea, which is kind of weird and awkward when you're boating around. But I don't know. I think it's fun, and the game moves pretty quickly, and I like the premise. So, yeah, I'm still playing. I probably put like 20-some hours into it already. So,
how far are you, Michael?
About 10 hours in. I haven't got to the random encounters with the sea battles or anything like that.
Okay.
I hadn't played much because I've been playing StarCraft II, but I have got some multiplayer experience in there. It was a blast to play with two people. Just the whole system they have is really geared toward multiplayer.
From what I was reading, it seems almost like a multiplayer game that you can play for, like, single player.
Single player, it's built from the ground up. It's wonderful.
Okay.
I think it really shines multiplayer. Okay. I mean, all your heroes are silent. They have no personality.
Right.
They're meant to be exchanged for another player.
Greg, have you played any multiplayer?
No, I have not. And it definitely seems like a multiplayer game. And that almost put me off. The whole idea of everyone on your group being silent protagonists.
Yeah.
Sounded like awful. Part of the reason people play Japanese RPGs is for their story.
Yeah.
And I'm like, well, you know, who are all these people with me then? What does it matter? But I don't know. I think it still worked out. And I guess it's not bothering me at all. I'd really like to play multiplayer, and I think the opportunity is going to be coming up the next week or so.
A couple of things. I mean, I haven't gotten the game yet, and I've been considering it. But one of the things actually was, like you were saying, the silent protagonist and stuff, because one of the main draws for me in a Japanese RPG is it's not just the story, but it's like the characters and the interaction between the characters. I find that JRPGs are really strong in that. And so the fact that not only your character, but also the other characters in the party are all silent kind of made me hesitate a little. And then also the fact that it seemed to be designed for multiplayer, but I wasn't going to have much of a chance to actually play multiplayer.
The single player campaign, I mean, it's, you can play through the whole thing, and if there were no multiplayer function announced or it was, you know, hidden, you would never know that this was built for multiplayer. I mean, it's fully functional. You know, I've played more single player than multiplayer, and it's fine. The story, it's no Final Fantasy XIII, or it's never going to give you that, you know, you're not going to care for the characters as much as you would a game like that.
Right.
But the story I found is actually kind of intriguing. I mean, it's lighthearted at times, kind of, it's got this Earthbound vibe to it. It doesn't take itself too seriously. There's tons of puns. Almost all the monsters' names are puns for something in the English language. It's funny.
I heard it had really good localization, which it always takes to get puns.
Yeah, Nintendo did a really good job at that. Like they did Mario and Luigi Superstar Saga 3 or whatever.
Yeah.
It's kind of that localization. It's funny. They have lots of puns. Same style. But the story is actually, it's engaging. Like the second, I think it's the second town you come to, it has a really, really good story. And it's tragic. I mean, it sometimes reminds me of the movie Up. It looks so childish and for kids and everything, but there are a few themes and something that the adults walk away with. So
Greg, you're farther along in the game without any spoilers. I mean, do you agree? Does the story hold up?
It's basically, I mean, the basic premise is that you're kind of like a guardian angel and you're trying to, you know, it's kind of like Touched by an Angel or something. You're going from town to town and just solving people's problems, and that kind of moves the game along. So that's where I kind of like it. It's very unusual, and you know, it's in a way unselfish for an RPG. Usually the guy's just trying to save the world and, you know, whatever. You know, right now there's no big bad. I'm guessing there will be, but I kind of, you know, it's got its own little vibe going, and I almost think that, you know, Mike mentioned the puns and the translation. It is very excellent. Nintendo might have gone a little overboard on some of their dialects. It's very dialect heavy. Each town has its own kind of
thing.
And as the game progresses, they get like stronger and stronger. And sometimes you're like, what are they saying?
So they're like writing it in dialect.
The Dragon Quest series have done dialect like that. Like, I've recently played 5.
Okay.
And I don't know if y'all have seen the main character on 8, Yangus. He has an accent like that. They kind of look like ogre-looking people.
Hmm.
But all the Dragon Quest games have always had real heavy accents and, like, the font and stuff like that. They speak funny.
That's weird. Okay.
Yeah, it's not quite like the what is it? The Starman people, or what? Oh, what are those guys called?
Saturn.
Yeah, the Saturn people.
So there's no voice acting, right?
No. There are a few animated movies, intro and cinematic events and stuff like that.
Okay.
Yep.
Aside from the story, I've heard it takes about maybe 20 hours to complete the main story. But, I mean, it's been played in Japan, like, average time is like 90 to 120 hours.
Yeah.
It's in a ridiculous amount of gameplay because of the treasure map feature.
Yeah.
Greg, have you messed with the treasure map feature at all?
No, I have not yet.
Well, you get these treasure maps, and do you know anything about tag mode?
Just from like the booklet or reading Nintendo Power.
Yeah. Well, the big thing in Japan was the tag mode, where you can just walk around and go to a public train station or something, and you just get swarms of people who come to your inn, and they can attach a treasure map, and you can take that treasure map, and then it would randomly generate a dungeon, and you could go to that dungeon, get loot, and fight boss, and all that good stuff. But it hasn't, in America, it just doesn't work. You know, Paul, I went to Distant Worlds Final Fantasy concert.
Yeah.
I mean, that's a nerd fest. And there's like 1,500 nerds just balled up in a concert theater hall. And I went in tag mode. I got 3 people.
Oh, my goodness.
Only 3 people. And, you know, we walked around Houston. Nobody. Nobody goes in tag mode.
Well, I heard at Comic-Con last week, or this past week or whatever, it was pretty good for that. They said... who was it? I think it was somebody from Joystick, maybe, said they went and they picked up, like, a dozen maps or something like that while they were there. Although, again, there's, like, thousands and thousands of people that were there, and so to only pick up, like, a dozen, that's still not
And one of the guys on 1UP said he purposely took the bus that the children take to school. I think he's in San Francisco or something. He said it's a little creepy, but he just wanted to test to see if somebody would get him in tag mode, like kids or something. He said, not a lick. No, right. So it's an awesome feature. I wish it could have worked in America, but without a public transit. And
see, in America, you have to use – it would have to be on the internet.
Yeah.
Because, you know, that way if I have the game and, you know, if all three of us have the game and then we can connect over the Wi-Fi network and trade maps with each other that way, you know, that would be much more intriguing than the tag mode where we are probably never – we're going to have to plan to get together. You know, like, Mike, me and you might be able to trade off maps or something at some point, but it would be too forced.
Yeah.
It's not like the intention where you just kind of accidentally stumble across the...
Well, they took the easy road out. I think they should have done something like the Me Parade, you know, how you can just put it on there. Basically, your friends, it'll pull their Mies into your parade, and then also the friends of friends, it'll pull their Mies. So basically, just a chain effect, and it starts, you know...
Exactly.
I put in your friend code, and now Paul sends his... He comes and stays in my end. And then Paul's friends stay in my end, and then it's just a big chain effect.
Right.
But I guess they just took the easy way out.
You can't play multiplayer online at all, right? It's all local.
No, it's all local, which I understand why. I mean, you can be in totally separate areas of the game. I mean, it's almost like a, you know, MMO. The game's so big, and you can even fight battles on your own on one side, and then him go and fight battles on his side, or you can group up together and fight. I mean, I see why they'd have a difficult time on, you know, the structure on the DPS, but...
Well, okay, so Dragon Quest is one of the most popular game series in Japan, but it's never really hit it off very big in the U.S., so do you think this is going to be, like, the game that... Which is what they were hoping, but apparently didn't put too much faith in it because Square Enix didn't even publish the game here, So,
I think it'll sell well, but it's still going to be niche and only for the hardcore.
I mean, what do you think, Greg? I've heard a lot of good stuff about the game. Like, almost everybody that I've heard of who's played it really enjoyed it. So do you think it's going to...
Yeah, I think it's going to do... I think it's doing well, and I think it's going to continue doing well, so... which I'm happy for Nintendo for picking it up.
Yeah.
I'm glad someone brought it because it's definitely an epic game in its own right, so.
Pick it up if you enjoyed Earthbound or Chrono Trigger. Definitely worth picking up. I mean, it's Chrono Trigger's battle system with an Earthbound vibe to it.
Well, I wouldn't go as far to say it's Chrono Trigger's battle system.
Just that
it's Dragon Quest battle system.
Well, I mean, I guess it's not active time, but you do see the monsters before you attack, and you got your...
Yeah, that's a good point. The monsters aren't, like, positioned, like, in Chrono Trigger, though.
Yeah.
Where pop up. Right. Yeah,
they pop up.
Which is fine, because, you know, Chrono Trigger is very, you know, it's for the perfect experience of the monsters here and here and here, but, you know, this is all about... There's a lot of grinding in Dragon Quest, which is actually kind of fun for some strange reason.
Okay.
Yeah.
Interesting.
It goes quickly, and, I mean, the purpose of... When you create a character, you pick a class, and that character can change class at any time. So there's, like, 12 classes in the game, so...
And the game is... Yeah, it's pretty much endless, because if you choose another class at a later point, you go all the way back to level 1.
Okay.
Correct.
But you keep all your skill points that you earned in that previous class. So you can basically... I mean, there's hidden classes as well. I don't know how many there are in total. But basically, the gameplay is endless.
Cool. All right. Well, that's Dragon Quest IX for you. Alright, so there's this game that's come out that I think a few people were kind of looking forward to. It's a sequel to... Okay, it's a sequel to, like, one of the most popular games ever, StarCraft II. Michael, you have been playing StarCraft II, correct?
Yes. 12 years is too long to wait for a sequel. But it is worthy. It is definitely worthy of the wait.
It's worth 12 years of wait? That's a long time.
Well, I mean, since you don't really have a choice, it's not like whether it's worth 12, you know, a certain amount of money, because you don't have a choice. You just had to wait 12 years for it, so.
It's just strange that I played this as a child, and it's not like it's StarCraft 13.
Right.
This is StarCraft 2.
The second one. Okay, so how is it? Okay, Greg, have you ever played the original StarCraft?
Very little, unfortunately.
Okay. I had never played the original StarCraft either. And I played a little bit of the multiplayer beta earlier this year, probably like 5 games, I think.
So coming into the series, what'd you think? Is it, you know, since I played when I was a kid, I knew how to do everything. I knew what the units were. It just felt right. But for you, was it a little overwhelming? Or what did you think about the beta?
The first game, the very first game we played, that you and I played against each other, I mean, not against, but we played co-op first, right, was overwhelming. But I was like, I didn't know the build order, you know, like what I was supposed to have built in order to build the better units and stuff like that. But after the second game, really, I really started getting the hang of it, to the point where I was starting to be able to develop strategies, you know, which is what the game's about. So it really didn't take that long to get into it. And I think the third game or the fourth game I played, I beat somebody, whoever I was playing, and he had played the original StarCraft. So I felt pretty good about that. But so from you who've played both the original and StarCraft II, how different is it, but how much is it the same?
The concept is almost exactly the same. I mean, it is StarCraft 1 with a new
graphics engine.
New graphic engine, new everything. But, you know, if you tried to go back and play StarCraft 1, you would see the vast differences.
Yeah, and one thing I noticed, just to interrupt you here, when I played the StarCraft 2 beta, to me, that's what I thought StarCraft 1 looked like. But then I went back and watched videos of StarCraft 1, and it looks really awful now.
Yeah, it's grainy, it's... It's aged.
Yeah.
I mean, it's not like PS1 era Final Fantasy VII aged.
Right.
You know, they're sprite-based graphics.
Right. So
they don't age as bad.
So as far as gameplay, what have they mixed up? Like new units, new... I mean, they didn't add any new races or anything like that.
They made it faster to gather minerals. They made some AI changes.
Yeah.
Like the pathing of your units. Previously in the old game, you'd move your units and they'd walk in a row.
Right.
So, you know, they just keep getting picked off.
Okay.
Pathing, they'll stay grouped up in a ball together. They'll attack at the same time. They won't just get individually picked off by the other computer or, you know, the other guy. The game's much faster. It's much easier to pump out units. I think you saw the Terran. You know, you can build 2 units at once.
Yes.
If you put on a certain reactor. Zerg, you can spawn larva, which basically means more units for the Zerg. Protoss has Chrono Boost, which makes any production building faster. So it's easier to get the ball rolling and get the game. You're not just watching your mineral gatherers go back and forth gathering minerals the whole time. You can pump out units and do something with those units faster.
Okay, so you get to the meat of the gameplay quicker.
Right, and I mean, it's like, this is 7 years of development time, and, you know, before the open beta that we were in, they had a closed beta.
Right.
So, I mean, the game's been tested, tried, and true. And, I mean, it's eSport quality gaming. I mean, it is balanced to the core. 3 races that are vastly different like that, possible feat, but Blizzard always, always, always balances their game in, with patches and whatnot, and the games last forever. I mean, StarCraft 1 is still a viable game to play.
Yeah.
It's played in Korea up to the release of StarCraft 2.
Yep.
You know, and it was viable. Strategies were viable. Nothing was broken or anything like that.
Which makes you, I don't know, that makes me realize, like, why exactly they waited 12 years to put out StarCraft 2, because if the first game lasts that long, they didn't need another game. And a lot of publishers, they'll want to push out another game just for more sales. But in this case, it's almost like they proved to you by letting it go this long that the second one is worth it, you know?
Right. I mean, that's Blizzard's way, tried and true.
Yeah.
The campaign, I mean, the campaign's really solid. It is vastly different from the first.
Okay.
The multiplayer, I mean, it's the similar concept as the first, but what has really changed is the single-player campaign.
Okay.
In the second one. It's got a, it's like a combination of several games in one. There's a, first off, it's not linear. You can choose which person you want to take missions from, whatnot. You have a star map. And, you know, you choose what areas you want to go to.
Okay.
And it kind of has an adventure game flair to it. It's similar to maybe Monkey's Island or what's that game for WiiWare? Strong Bads, cool game for attractive people. And that you can click on stuff and interact with, you know, there's a jukebox on the ship. So you click on the jukebox and it changes the song. Or you click on this person and talk to them. There's a picture on the table. You click on the picture. So you kind of investigate the world around you.
Okay.
And you get more insight on the story, what happened in the past StarCraft.
Okay.
Whatnot.
So they just put a lot of thought into this game.
Yeah, it's fleshed out. There's cutscenes. Like any big RPG, it has a long cutscene. Not long. Not Metal Gear Solid long, but there are cutscenes in the game.
Yeah.
As opposed to the first game, it had no cutscenes.
So, okay, so Greg, how much interest do you have in this game?
I want to write a first hour of it, because I'm coming in pretty much blind.
Okay.
So I think, as someone who's unfamiliar with the series, as I'm sure a lot of people are, and there's all this hype surrounding it, there's a lot of curiosity, so, you know, I'd like the opportunity to do that. Beyond that, I've never really, I don't know, I would be scared to go into multiplayer.
Yeah.
I guess now's the time to do it, though, when everyone's kind of new to it, so... I don't know.
Yeah.
Not enough to go out and buy it, unfortunately, but, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Well, I understand being scared about multiplayer. Sometimes I come home from work, I don't want to be stressed about, you know, building units or going against another human, but there is tons of cooperative play online. It's easy, you just press the cooperative button, and instantly you can be paired with another person and fight computer from easy to hard to brutal.
Okay.
And it's relaxed. There's, I don't know if you've seen the videos online of the different stuff you can create in StarCraft. Like they create Tetris.
Oh yeah, yeah.
Any like small RPGs, they'll give their units like hero abilities, and they'll create like a little mini RPG with a story. And it's just completely different from the standard RTS.
What you'd expect from a...
What you'd expect. I mean, it's completely slowed down. They'll have, like, hero wars where you'll be in control of basically one unit, and that unit has several different spells, and you go into an arena with a bunch of other people, and it's almost like a Diablo clone in that you're casting different spells, moving to the high ground.
Hmm.
You know, totally different mindset from what the game was originally, you know.
Wow, yeah, that's surprising. I mean...
But yeah, the game is vastly improved. It's well worth the money, I believe, and you will be playing it from a long time to come until StarCraft III, when we are, what, 40, 45?
Yeah, something like that. Just about.
Midlife crisis, need a bit of nostalgia.
Well, what's the? I mean, this is a trilogy, right? This is like.
That's true.
First of two more, but are they gonna? I mean, what are they adding besides single-player campaigns? Does anyone know?
Well, I know the Terran campaign is 29 missions, and the average time is 16 to 20 hours to complete that, which the original game was about, you know, you could beat it in 15 hours, and that was all three races, Terran, Protoss, Zerg. You know, you could beat less than 15 hours. So the game's a lot bigger. I mean, it's 16 to 20 is if you're rushing through. If you're doing all that you can explore, all the different side missions, researching all the stuff that you can collect and improve your ships and weapons and all that, it'll take you a lot longer. And on top of the achievement system built in, I mean, there's a ton of content for single player. So each of the expansion packs are going to be, you know, the Zerg, it's going to be centered on them. It's going to be roughly 29 missions long. And from what I've heard on the forums and stuff, it's going to be different from the Terran campaign. It's going to be different gameplay.
Okay.
So, you know, like earlier we were talking about those mini RPGs, how you're kind of in control of one character.
Yeah.
It may have some different stuff like that. It's not going to be the same RTS stuff going on.
So, okay, but is the multiplayer going to stay the same?
Yeah, the multiplayer stays the same. They'll probably add, you know, each race gets two new units on an expansion pack, but multiplayer will stay vastly, you know, the same throughout the entire trilogy. It's like the original StarCraft had the expansion Brood Wars. That added a new campaign, which is, you know, roughly 15 hours to complete, but it also added to each race two or three new units to control.
Okay, for multiplayer.
You know, changed up multiplayer a bit, but not much.
Well, I heard that in the future they may be adding 3D support to StarCraft 2. Is that...
That's what they said. Blizzard said that I think relatively soon they're going to patch it for 3D monitors.
So, I mean, how do you... Like, do you think that's really going to add anything to this game?
No, I mean, it's just probably going to be gimmicky. You know, wow, there's a Zerg popping out, you know. But for an RTS, I really don't see. And, you know, you got to be finely tuned when you're in multiplayer, looking at everything. And, you know, 3D, if you kind of shift to the side, everything gets all blurry.
Yeah.
You know, if you're not looking at your monitor straight on. So when you're moving around like that and tapping on your keyboard as fast as you do to keep up in multiplayer, I can see it being more of a hindrance than a advantage for players who try and go 3D.
Yeah, I mean, 3D is it's a buzzword right now. You know, every company wants to say something 3D, this or that. Greg, I mean, you hadn't played StarCraft 2, but what about the other games that are, you know, Sony is trying to push 3D to the PlayStation 3. Nintendo has the 3DS. There's 3D gaming on the PC.
Well, I don't really like the idea of wearing glasses while gaming.
Right.
I don't know. I guess I've become a little more casual, if you could say that. Not Farmville casual, but
yeah,
a lot of Super Mario Galaxy 2 kind of casual. And I'm loving that. And, yeah, I play with my kid and... You know, do we have to wear glasses for both of us not to get eye strain just to enjoy some time together? So, I don't know. I'm very intrigued about the 3DS. I want to see it in person before I kind of make a final decision.
Definitely.
But, I don't know. I'm probably more excited about the 3DS just because it's better hardware. So, I like, you know, if we can push a couple new genres on the DS, that would be awesome. So
what excited me, and actually this at first I thought this was a little weird, but the slider, the adjustment for the depth of the 3D on the 3DS, at first I thought that was a little weird, but now that I think about it, or since then that I've thought about it, I realized that that's its saving grace, because at this point I would be reluctant to put down money for a game system and then pay for games afterward that I was going to have to play in 3D all the time. And so, you know, supposedly they're putting Ocarina of Time on the 3DS. And if they do, I'm probably going to buy a 3DS and Ocarina of Time. But as I was thinking about that, I was like, oh, but I'm probably going to get tired of looking at it in 3D. And then I thought, oh, but I can just turn it off. Right. So that right there, I mean, they basically had to have that, but also the adjustment is because not everybody's eyes see it the same way, and so you adjust it until it focuses correctly for your eyes. And then if your eyes are, like, if they do focus correctly, then you can adjust the depth. But anyway, the problem with that is it means that devs can't really make games that rely on 3D because you can turn it off.
Well, I don't know.
They can make, I mean, they could make parts of games maybe that relied on 3D to where you had to turn it on to see it, but I don't know, but it just seems like...
There's plenty of DS games that don't require a stylus. I don't know.
No, I know what you're saying. Like, right, I'm not saying that it's going to make the games bad. Like, there will still be lots of good games, and like you said, it's a DS, only it's more powerful, so that has to be a plus. And it has the new analog slider pad, and it has, you know, higher resolution screens, a wide screen on top. I mean, and the new Wi-Fi, whatever it is. I mean, they haven't detailed too much about that, but the way it connects to the internet is supposedly better. So, I mean, it's a much better DS, even with the 3D off. And I guess the glasses-less 3D is just a really kind of cool thing to be able to turn on every now and then and look at, if at the very least, you know?
Right.
Well, I was going to say that I find that, you know, each generation with each iteration of Nintendo consoles, it's pretty catchy there, huh? I tend to not embrace the new technology they bring in. Like, for example, the DS, I have maybe two games that use it.
Mm-hmm.
Metroid Prime Hunters and Trauma Center, I think.
Okay.
But other than that, there are no games that I use the stylus with. It's all classic RPGs or, you know.
You played Phantom Hourglass, didn't you?
Yeah, on the PS2. I never played on the Wii. Oh, yeah, I'm sorry. So, yeah.
Legend of Zelda.
Zelda. Yeah, I did.
Yes.
And I didn't like controlling it that way.
Okay.
I mean, it worked. It was nice, but
right. It
was kind of gimmicky. Like, yeah, I could just do this with a controller as well.
Okay.
It didn't add anything for me. And the same thing with the Wii. I mean...
I just think there's a lot of great games on the DS that use stylus only, like Kirby Canvas Curse. And
Yeah. There are a lot of good games on the DS, but... There are probably more games that don't use it that are good than that use it and are good, I think.
I mean,
think about the Wii, Paul. I mean, how many games use the Wiimote and are top-notch, and how many games don't use the Wiimote and are top-notch? I mean, I can look at my collection right now and, you know, three or four games use the Wiimote.
The rest
are classic controller or, you know,
Waggle.
Like, you know, Mario Galaxy is just you shake to spin. Zelda, you shake to just throw the sword.
Right. I mean, really, until they added on the Motion Plus, there wasn't a whole lot you could do with it. Like,
there's two games for that.
So far, yeah. I mean, WarioWare Smooth Moves, I found, used the remote really well.
Yeah, there's some good games, and it does help with, like, you know, my wife's parents are from a farm in the middle of nowhere, and they have a Wii. I mean,
it
obviously works with some people, and it makes games accessible for some people.
Yeah.
But I'm just worried that with 3D, you know, it's probably going to be on the back burner for me. It's going to maybe be two or three games. I could see a Mario Kart, like, whoa, the shells are coming at me.
Yeah.
But like Greg said, I'm in it for the graphics and upgraded hardware.
Yeah. Well, okay, so you had already mentioned, Greg, about Sony's idea of 3D is their new 3D TVs, and then with the PlayStation 3 doing 3D games with the new patch. But you'll have to sit on, you know, you'll be sitting on your couch with your controller, and you'll be wearing a pair of glasses. To me, wearing glasses for something like a theater, although I've never actually watched a 3D movie in the theaters, but the idea of wearing glasses to watch a 3D movie in a theater makes sense. Because you're there just to watch the movie, and it's only for a couple of hours, and you're just going to, you know, you're just going to sit there, put the glasses on, and watch the movie. But when you get home and you want to play a video game in the evening or something like that, you don't really want to, like you said, you know, are there, if somebody else is going to be watching the game, are they going to have to be wearing a pair of glasses too? Or are you going to have to be... What about people who have glasses? Are they going to have to wear another pair on top?
Yeah, huge investment, and it's going to take a lot of convincing. Like, you need a 3D TV
for
the consoles. It just, I don't know. It just seems like the wrong time for them to be focusing on, oh, you just bought an expensive TV, but now it's not the right one.
So. Right. And especially since there's no standard for 3D yet, to where, like, all glasses will work with all TVs and all TVs will work with all systems and everything like that, they haven't standardized it enough to where you can just buy a TV and be sure that you're going to be able to watch all 3D content with it, you know? You do have to wonder, do I have the right cable to plug my PS3 into my TV? Did I get a Sony TV, or is my, you know, like, whatever, Hitachi going to work with my PS3 or whatever? Does Hitachi even make TVs? Probably not 3D TVs. Anyway. So, I think the idea of a portable handheld system where the screen is built in, so you don't have to worry about buying another, you know, display. You don't have to worry about wearing glasses. And the reason they can do that is because with a handheld system like that, they pretty much know exactly where your face is going to be compared to the screen when you're playing it, because you hold it in front of your face, you know, and the distance that you hold it, well, you can adjust that with the slider. So I think that's,
you know, I mean, they mentioned that if you move your head, you know, too far left or right, the 3D disappears.
Yes.
Is it that it actually looks bad?
I don't.
Or is it just gone? Like, if someone was watching you play
the 3D, I'm not sure. But yeah, if somebody's watching you, you may just have to turn off the 3D in order for them to see. I don't know. Because the way that it works, without going into too much, like, technical details right now, but it would be, if somebody's looking off to the side, they would only see half of the image, but that wouldn't actually look bad. You would just see it from a different perspective than, so it would be, it probably wouldn't completely ruin it. But as far as playing by yourself, I mean, how often do you play the DS with it turned at an angle? You know, you're going to be looking straight at the screen.
Yeah, I'm not really concerned about just me, so.
Okay.
But, you know, my kids
get, if somebody's, yeah,
good point. So, and I know you play with your kids, so.
Yep. But Nintendo had actually mentioned, I think Satoru Iwata mentioned that they've been trying to do 3D, obviously, since the Virtual Boy, but that they experimented with ways to do it on the GameCube, where it would have a, I believe for the GameCube they were going to have a peripheral that would fit over the screen, like over your TV, but obviously the logistics of that are kind of ridiculous, and so they didn't do it. Yeah, and then for the Wii, they considered it again, and it was going to be something like, it was going to have its own screen built in or something like that. Maybe it was the other way around. The GameCube was going to, it was going to be like a screen that you added onto it or something like that. And the other one, anyway, it was weird stuff that they were trying to figure out, and they said it never worked because with consoles, you have a separate console, and it, you know, it's separate from the TV, but with the DS, it's all built in. So I don't know.
I'm sure eventually 3D will be the standard on most things. I don't know. I mean, well, maybe not, but,
well,
I guess I'm, yeah, I don't know.
Yeah, I think this 3D, like the stereo vision or whatever, is going to be phased out at some point for actual 3D displays, to where you can actually move around it and see more than just straight on.
Well, that would be amazing, of course. So.
Yeah, but I mean, it'll happen eventually. It can't not happen. There've already been showcases of that kind of technology, not that, you know, you can buy, but that you can at least gawk about online. So
sure.
So I mean, yeah, that'll be, I guess, you know, hopefully it happens before we're too old to
still see it.
To care, yeah, exactly. Too old to care or whatever. Thanks for listening to episode 7 of the First Hour Podcast, the official podcast of firsthour.net. You can email questions or comments to podcast@firsthour.net. You can subscribe through our RSS feed on the site or through iTunes. I'm your host, Paul Eastwood, for Greg Noe.
Thanks for listening.
And Michael Thornton.
Sayonara.
And we're out.